You're listening to Episode 9 of The Gearheart. I'm your reader, writer, and host, Alex White. Renee White is the voice of our female characters. If you haven't had a chance yet, or you're listening on iTunes or Podiobooks.com, you can stop by the Gearheart blog and interact at www.thegearheart.com. Or you can also email me directly at alex@thegearheart.com. Don't forget that you can follow us on Twitter, username TheGearheart. And now, settle in, pour a cup of tea, and enjoy as we bring you more tales of the Gearheart. Last time on the Gearheart, the Fumiston Seekers arrive at the clubhouse on the edge of town and settle in for the planning of their latest mission. As Darren analyzes the motives of the elusive Cirrus, he learns that his chapter may be the hangman's target. What will they do? How will they stop him? Find out on the Gearheart.
Ask you something, Gus.
Isabel began as soon as Keegan and Darren were gone. The meeting had extended into the early hours of the morning, and Isabel rubbed her tired eyes. Augustus took a sip of his lab coffee, a brew made from a few herbs and chemicals that he swore tasted like real coffee, and smiled. Sure, can I get you some coffee?
That stuff tastes like licorice and salt lick. I have no idea how I'd drink it if you did.
Augustus's eyebrows shot up as he spoke into his mug. Testy?
Actually, yes,
said Isabel.
I am.
Augustus put down his mug and picked up a nearby beaker. Pulling out a dishcloth, he began to polish the clear crystal.
With you,
Isabel followed. Oh! Augustus put down the beaker and leaned back on the lab table behind him. He started to knock over some instruments and caught them. Well, I'm sorry, he stumbled.
Sorry that I'm testy?
No, I'm sorry for what I did.
I haven't told you what you did.
Well, I'm sure I should be sorry for it, said Augustus. Isabel felt like someone had suddenly clipped her fuse. She wondered if that hadn't been his plan all along. She forced herself to refocus on the issue.
I want to know why you have a problem with Jonathan. You used to get along so well with him.
Who wouldn't have a problem with that guy? He's a louse, Augustus stated, as though it was the end of the argument.
He doesn't bother anyone but you, Gus.
I beg to differ, Augustus spat, intensifying his cleaning. He's not sleeping in my lab, if that's why you're asking about him.
That's not the issue at hand here. You could have told him no earlier, but you chose to get snippy.
I still told him no, didn't I? Augustus snapped. I think you're just blinded by the way you feel about him. Isabel felt a small explosion in her stomach. So he'd gotten her to lower her guard just so he could start a fight on his own terms. Her hands balled up, and she looked right into his eyes. She spoke in low tones through tense lips.
Do you remember what happened to turn your hair white?
Of course. I got careless in the lab.
And what are you doing right now?
From the look on her face, Augustus got the thrust of her argument. I'm sorry I was critical of you. I shouldn't be, he said, turning his back to polish the beaker. After all, he's the one that annoys me.
But why?
You know how all of us have these amazing talents at our command? How we've honed our skills for years through the study of the arcane? Isabel's eyes registered disgust.
You're mad because he's a prodigy.
Augustus turned to stare right into her eyes. It was a cold, unblinking look that seemed to drill into her. She'd never seen her compatriot make such a face before. It was as though he hadn't slept for days, only to find out some terrible news. No, Isabel. I'm mad because he's a butcher. Isabel cracked an awkward smile. She was expecting to hear about how Jonathan was butchering protocol, or how he butchered one of Augustus's inventions, or even how he butchered D.D. McGee songs in the bath every morning. Augustus's face told Isabel that she couldn't expect any statements of that type from him.
What do you mean?
She stammered. I mean that I was there the night that he killed the remaining Antonellos, Isabel. He didn't see me, but I saw him, Augustus said, adjusting his posture. He was no longer fiddling with his coffee or beakers or equipment. Every faculty of the young agent with the short attention span was focused upon the conversation, and that fact frightened Isabel.
That was self-defense.
Call it whatever you want, but when you skewer a human as he begs for mercy, you're a butcher.
Those alchemists were dangerous men, Gus. You know what Harold did to his people? Jonathan couldn't possibly take the chance of capturing one.
Your friend didn't kill him quickly, all right? Jonathan couldn't control himself, and he tortured Harold, Augustus said, cocking his head. I guess he didn't tell you that. Isabel's chest felt like it was full of cotton. Her upper lip quivered, and she felt her jaw muscles tense.
Even if you're right, even if Jonathan can't control his powers, shouldn't we take pity on him and try to help him?
He needs to try to help himself first, Isabel, Augustus barked. If he cared one iota for anybody but King Jonathan, he'd be out there trying to get a hold of himself.
Maybe he is, Gus. Maybe you just can't see it because you're scared of him,
Isabel shouted back.
The least you could do is offer him some help every now and again.
I helped him rebuild Cog with Seeker money, Isabel. That is where my commitment to that man ends.
Listen to yourself, Gus! You didn't talk like this when I first met you.
I've grown up a lot, I think, said Augustus. His gaze drifted over to the elemental cannon and lingered just a little too long. Mark my words, Isabel. We're gonna find ourselves fighting him one of these days. Isabel suddenly felt too sick to continue the conversation and fled the room before Augustus could speak again. Lightning slithered across the sky as peals of thunder slammed the house like great crumbling boulders. Jonathan lay bundled in his bed, wrapped in layers and layers of blankets, with a smoldering coal bed warmer tucked in below him. The frosty air pressed against his nose and leached the warmth from his head. To his right, a paraffin lamp choked out a pitiful globe of heat and warmth. It didn't do much, though, as icy rain clawed at the shuddering planks of the farmhouse. It seemed as though, any minute, the window would crash inward, releasing a deluge of water into the room. The winter storms that exploded on the cusp of spring in Fumiston were particularly sudden and incredibly violent. The ferocity of the weather was because of the incredible amount of soot generated by the outlying factories. The granules would get into the clouds and cause them to drop their watery payloads across the harbor valley. It was not unheard of for docked ships to simply buck their moorings and wander off to sea during the rainy months. Dock workers had to come up with a delicate balance between moorings that were too long and ropes that were so short they would capsize the vessel. The poor districts near the harbor were highly susceptible to flooding and often carried 6 to 8 inches of water in the streets. Even Jonathan's family estate, a posh townhouse in the higher areas, had at least a few leaks in the roof. Jonathan thought of Milton, bustling about with buckets in the upstairs, grousing about living in a house that came with leaks and no butler. And the young man's hand fell to the scar on his stomach. If he thought hard enough, Jonathan could still remember Harold Antonello's blade as it entered his gut, the searing pain, and the horrible feeling of tearing. That one scar marked his initiation into the world of magic like a tattoo. Jonathan had almost died that night in his own house, right there in front of Milton, and he knew his uncle would remember Jonathan's wound the moment they called to tell him about the mission. Jonathan's first ordeal with the Seekers had only gotten worse after his wound. Donovan Ashley, the youngest member, was killed in a duel with one of the other Antonellos, and Cog's original body had been all but destroyed. With Augustus's help, the Seekers were able to restore her to her original condition, but it was a long process. Worse still, the main branch in Cerceval discovered Cog's existence and began to requisition her for missions, as well as document some of her inner workings. Jonathan had no reason to believe that they would try anything so dangerous as duplicating Cog's father's 1,000-year-old formula. But the thought of her schematics in Seeker hands made Jonathan uncomfortable. After all, the great Jacopo Antonello had sacrificed plenty of people in his twisted experiments before he produced Cog. Milton knew everything that happened back then, and the prospect of Jonathan going back out would worry Milton to death. Jonathan had only ever known his uncle, and Milton was the only family that the young man had. If anything happened to Jonathan, his uncle would be completely alone in the world, with the sunset of old age rapidly approaching. Milton would be angry. He would be destitute. Just thinking about his uncle made Jonathan's stomach tie itself into knots. Of course, he was also famished. The young man hadn't eaten since 2 hours before they picked up Isabel at the docks, and his angry gut growled ever so slightly to punctuate the point. He would have to get up and eat if he ever wanted to get some sleep. The conundrum lay in the fact that, were he to get out from under the covers, he would have to face the cold. His clothes had been on the lacquered wooden floor for more than 10 minutes, ensuring their low temperature. His shoes were presumably by the door, though the room was dark enough that they were still well hidden. The walk to get just the shoes would be like traipsing over broken ice. So the dilemma was, face the discomfort of hunger, or face the discomfort of the cold house. The moment Jonathan pulled away the covers, the arctic air in the room rushed underneath to claw at his pajama-clad legs. He reflexively sucked in a breath, effectively lowering his body temperature. By the time that he'd leapt onto the bitter floorboards, he was shaking uncontrollably and feeling pins and needles in his feet. "Go, go, 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 go," Jonathan whispered to himself, dancing over to his loafers and slipping them on. Without thinking, he reached over to a nearby chair, snatched his leather jacket off the back, and slipped it over his shoulders. A new level of shuddering overtook Jonathan's form as the stored cold in the jacket seeped into his body. Jonathan wanted to jump up and down to generate a little heat in his bones, but he was afraid of waking anyone, and knew that sound carried far in the house. He didn't want to risk being discovered shivering pathetically as the others would laugh and call him a wimp. Reluctantly forcing his arms away from his torso, he took hold of the doorknob, feeling the metal bite into his hands. The door creaked open, revealing the hallway beyond. The cold, blue-flamed lamps in the ceiling never went out unless a special phrase was uttered, so they stayed alight into the evening. Their azure glow seemed to make the abandoned planks before Jonathan even colder, and though he tried to control himself, he still left audible footfalls. Jonathan crept down the stairs and into the empty main room just outside the kitchen. He was hoping that Cog would have brought some chilled meats or cheeses from the townhouse, but failing that, he was certain that Keegan would at least have some dry oats, some cinnamon, and water. Hopefully, he could simply sneak in, take a few small cuts out of everyone's breakfast, and get away with the food before anyone else noticed. Since the living arrangements were provisional at best, Jonathan knew that there would be risks. Risks like suffering through the cold for a completely empty kitchen. "Hello?" Jonathan softly sang, his voice trailing off. No reply. He shuffled out into the kitchen. The same blue glow that flickered through the rest of the house resonated through the kitchen like a heartbeat. The pale luminescence of the lightning outside slapped against the walls, punctuating the shadows of the kitchen. Marble slab counters had been constructed over ceramic tile floors, and enough pots and pans hung from racks in the ceiling to prepare a meal for an army. On one side of the room stood a massive brick oven with a meat rack and several dry logs inside. Near the oven was a smaller wood-burning stove that looked as though it was a few decades old, its eyes completely blackened with ancient overuse. Jonathan couldn't remember ever using any of the kitchen equipment in the course of business. Clearly, when the Seekers created the clubhouse many years ago, they had a more resourceful group of individuals in mind. Somewhat closer to the door of the kitchen was the device that Jonathan sought, a steel meat locker with an insulated interior. It had an automatic cooling system created by Augustus that could reduce the temperature of foods inside to near freezing without drawing from an electrical grid. It also ran much quieter than its mundane, diesel-powered counterparts. Apparently, the cooling system was quite an achievement, as they had mimicked his accomplishments in the main branch shortly after Augustus reported success on the device. Holding his breath, Jonathan grasped the handle and opened the door. Not only was the cooler devoid of any meats, it wasn't even active. It scarcely mattered, however, as Jonathan had trouble determining the status of the contraption in the current temperature. There was only one thing in the space before Jonathan, a smallish bag stenciled with the bold words, "Halwyn Cooperative HT." The young man knew exactly what it contained, Keegan Wilkinson's hardtack. The hardtack, or sea biscuits of Halwyn Co-op, were legendary amongst the sailors of the town and farmers alike for their permanence. They were used as military rations by the Northlander government during times of war, and the Halwyns of Fumiston had become veritable moguls in the food service industry because of their unique formula. Farmers in indigent areas loved the tack for the many recipes they could make once the bricks were softened, thrice baked in a pressure kiln with an unmistakable Halwyn brand pressed into each one. The simple flour and water biscuits were quite well known. And to say that Howland Hardtack had a famous taste would also be true. The old tooth dullers certainly put the water into water biscuit, their only flavor gleaned from a pinch of salt. The boys at the harbor always claimed that the pilot bread was made from equal parts water and nails, and Jonathan was inclined to agree. With a long sigh, Jonathan closed the cooler door. Only Keegan could be so utilitarian that he could subsist on hardtack. The young man quietly rued the fact that he was now cold, hungry, and so very, very awake. As Jonathan pressed his shoulder into the latch to secure it, something green on one of the tiles caught his eye. At first, he didn't really know what to make of it. It was a tiny emerald curl, about the length of his thumb, poking up through the space in the tile grout like an errant hair. Jonathan brushed over the thing with his toe, idly thinking it a piece of food left over by Augustus or Keegan in the days when the building had seen more use. It was a warm sprig of grass, warm like a wide open field on a hot summer day. Jonathan hunkered down onto his hands and knees and took a closer look at the plant. It was a soft shoot, adorned by one leaf and a slender stalk. The plant looked relatively young, and the light of the surrounding room passed perfectly through its length. The verdure positively glowed with warmth, creating a tiny globe of comfort around itself. "What's he doing down there?" Jonathan muttered, trying to peer past the plant to see the lights of Augustus's lab. A brief wave of anger flashed across Jonathan's mind. Why wasn't Jonathan allowed to light a heater if Augustus was going to crack the foundations and destroy the house with his experiments? Jonathan couldn't sleep in a controlled climate, but Augustus could go about invading what little comfort Jonathan had with all manner of alien foliage. That settled it. Jonathan was going to go down there and give the scientist what for. As he leapt to his feet, there was a tremendous crack. Not like the raging storm outside, but something rather more wooden. The house groaned and growled, and something massive clawed at the walls outside. Something like giant fingers. Something with the mass of a car. There was a horrible slithering, rustling sound in all directions, making its way through the walls, the ceiling, and even the floor. Then suddenly, everything stopped. Only a swaying creak was audible, though Jonathan's center of gravity was constantly shifted from one side to the other. A thin fissure appeared on the window. Gus? Jonathan breathed. The room exploded into a shrieking fury of plants, tile, rocks, and nails. The walls and ceiling ripped away as thousands of bark-covered tendrils rent them from their holds. The roots of some massive plant raked over the floor, toppling Jonathan from his feet and shoving him through a gaping hole where the wall previously stood. A flying board caught Jonathan squarely in the face, and his vision flashed white as he sailed into the air. Everything became quite a bit hotter and brighter. The air grew muggy and clung to Jonathan's freezing skin with a slick, wet film. The breeze was thick with the smells of pollen and grass. Jonathan ceased to understand up from down and his stomach flipped a few times. For a brief moment, the blinded young man felt weeds whipping at his left side before his rump slammed into the ground and he tumbled down a hill. A few jagged rocks sliced his already bruised back as he fell, eliciting several yelps from the young man. Finally, Jonathan came to a stop, and his head fell onto a soft pillow of clover and young grass. The overpowering smell of wildflowers assailed his nose, and Jonathan sneezed a few times in response. Without the distraction of falling, the pain of recent trauma crawled into his skin and rattled his bones. The young man cried out and curled into a ball, wheezing into the bed of plants. There he lay, quivering and wheezing, eyes tightly shut and teeth gnashing against the terrible injuries he had suffered.
Where am I? What is this place?
Jonathan had no idea how far he had fallen, how much time had passed, or whether or not anyone in the house had lived through whatever had happened. After what he'd seen, he wasn't even sure if he'd ever see the house again. Something nearby gurgled something at him, and the pain left as quickly as it had come.
"Hello?"
said Jonathan, wiping his eyes. He saw only bright sunlight, with no sign of the storm that had come before. The guttural utterance came again, followed shortly by heavy, padded footsteps. Whatever made the noise was big.
Hello there?
Jonathan's voice wavered, and he blinked wildly. A few overarching details came into view. The ground was entirely green, certainly not the dead grass and leaves of winter. Variegated dots of color, like exploding fireworks, littered the ground, and the sky was an oversaturated blue. And though all of this was incredibly strange, Jonathan found himself unable to focus on anything other than the hulking silhouette that lumbered toward him. As it closed on his position, its form rolled into focus. The creature was bipedal, with legs not unlike a goat's or a dog's, in that they bent rearwards at the knees, and massive feet. Its canine conveyance converged, with a tremendous muscular tail at the location of a flaccid pot belly. Above the stomach was a hunched set of shoulders attached to two arms that hung low at the creature's sides. Its many segmented fingertips curled and uncurled continuously, revealing blackened talons. Jonathan noted its supposable thumbs, though he doubted any of Milton's anthropology training would ever come in handy here. Matted golden fur covered the creature's body, running in white patches around the upper torso. Following the shoulders was a long, rippling neck and the creature's heads. Its face was the last piece of proof that Jonathan needed to confirm that he had never seen anything like it. Its bulbous eyes, which were set into either side of its cranium, were filled with sparkling green and yellow nerves, each catching the light in iridescent glory. Two membranes slid over the eyes, shielding them from harm like a frog's eyes. The creature's snout was distended from its face, about the length of Jonathan's forearm. Where there should have been a mouth, there was only a fleshy, jawless, baggy hole, pulsing with muscular action. Occasionally, a bit of black ichor would bubble about inside the orifice. The creature carried possibly the worst stench ever to touch the young man's delicate nostrils. It cocked its head at Jonathan and gurgled something else, its neck convulsing with enunciation. Its hand rose and a finger extended toward the young man in a pointing motion. "I don't know what you're saying," said Jonathan. He did his best to smile as largely as he could. The sight of Jonathan's rows of teeth seemed to frighten the creature. It let loose a wail like a rusty horn and galloped back a few steps. The shout echoed across the surrounding area, and Jonathan saw that he was in a tremendous mountain valley for the first time. The beast took a few powerful swipes at the ground, tearing away earth and grass as though it was nothing. In the wake of its sinewy fingers, only deep gashes in the dirt remained. Its heavy hands could easily smash Jonathan's bones, if it so desired. "Oh, don't do that. Oh, please don't do that." It bounced back and forth, howling hoarsely at the sky and spewing strands of black sludge from its mouth. Its speed was incredible, and the leg muscles under its short hair convulsed with power. The creature's toes tore huge divots in the ground, tossing grass into the air like dead leaves, and it charged straight for Jonathan.
"Whoa, whoa, whoa!"
Jonathan shouted, stumbling back onto his back. The thudding footfalls drew ever closer, and Jonathan braced himself to summon his sword. He closed his eyes, held out his hand, and began to reach back into himself. The pounding stopped. Jonathan opened his eyes to see the creature frozen above him, hand poised to strike, chest heaving with breath. A murmur burbled within its throat, but quickly evolved into a rhythmic, barking splash. The creature's arm fell limply to its side, its shoulders shaking in time, and it relaxed. Whatever it was laughing at him, which was not unfamiliar to Jonathan. "Where are my friends?" Jonathan grunted, rising to his feet. The creature wiped some of the slime away from its throat and flicked it into the nearby grass. "Can you understand me?" The creature leaned in close, allowing Jonathan a better look at its eyes than he would have liked, and examined Jonathan's mouth. It pinched the hairless skin at the base of its mouth hole and jiggled it up and down, gurgling wildly. The barking laughter shortly followed. "At least you've got a good sense of humor," Jonathan sighed. "Where are my friends?" More mimicry and laughter. "Enough of this." Jonathan tried to step past, but the creature bounded over to block the young man. The second time that Jonathan tried to step past, the laughing stopped, and the back of the creature's hand struck his face so hard that he was temporarily blinded. Hot breath seethed out of Jonathan's nostrils, and his gut exploded with rage. If the creature would not step aside, Jonathan determined that he would have to remove the obstacle. "Move." The creature refused. Jonathan reached out with his mind, delving into the deepest recesses of his past, to an era before he was born. He looked back through his own lineage, grasping for the hilt of a blade from within the ether. He sought the familiar tempest so that he could push through and find a dark and dreadful voice that would lend him strength. But it wouldn't answer him. The storm was gone. He had no weapon in this strange land. The cold sweat that coated Jonathan's body renewed its film. The creature straightened and took a step forward as Jonathan slumped ever so slightly. Even through the language barrier, the creature eloquently told the young man that he would not be joining his friends. If anyone was hurt, they would simply die without him. How could this have happened? Jonathan sighed. He raised his eyes to the sky. It was a beautiful blue, with perfect striations of clouds stretched across like white serpents. There was something very fake about it all, like it had been painted by some idealist rather than occurring naturally. However, Jonathan spotted a blemish, a flapping black shadow creeping across the horizon. It was beautiful, sailing through the skies like an airborne bolt of sackcloth. It cut back and forth, riding the currents as easily as a storm crow.
What is that thing?
A faint humming, like the resonation of a tuning fork, caressed Jonathan's ears, and he tried to clear them out with his fingers. Jonathan's stomach churned, and he felt as if someone had lit a candle beneath his lungs. Suddenly, the angry creature before him no longer mattered. It was just Jonathan in the shadow, alone in the world. The clouds above swirled into a single cocoon around the shadow like the bulb of a rose, and the sky bloomed into a fiery sunset. The brilliant orange hues gave way to lavender fades and gentle dusk as a wave of starry twilight spread over the land. The cool breeze picked up and ruffled Jonathan's hair, chilling his wet skin. When Jonathan's gaze finally fell earthward, the creature was gone. The wildflowers were gone too, gone with the daylight. Instead of grass, instead of life, the ground was carpeted with bones as far as the eye could see, the bones of humans. A stench like no other swept into Jonathan's lungs, stealing his breath, and he fell to his knees. An electric shiver bit into his spine when he realized that the sea of skeletons extended even beneath himself, and he clambered to his feet, stumbling over cracked skulls and loose ribs. It was only then that he realized that he was screaming. He willed his voice to obey him, to cease wailing, and it finally obeyed, though he could not stop shaking. "It will kill us," he breathed. "The shadow is going to kill us all." The shakes became more and more violent until Jonathan felt as though it was no longer his own body, but some outside force that bucked his torso. Just then, the kitchen snapped back into focus, and he was back in the dim blue light, completely undamaged. Jonathan felt Cog's cold, firm hands upon his shoulders, and looked past her to see Keegan, Augustus, Isabel, and Darren. Suddenly, his cold sweat felt colder. Augustus sucked in a breath through a worried frown. "Tell me that doesn't count as a prophecy. Now, when you say us all, you aren't just talking about the Seekers?" Darren prompted. "I mean everyone," Jonathan replied. It was as though Jonathan's words sucked away all the air in the room. There was no sound, no movement, no talking. After a moment, a thunderbolt punctured the silence, and everyone breathed again. "I think we understand the gravity of this situation now, gentlemen," Keegan replied with a cold stare. "Cog, let's get Mr. Andrews back to bed, shall we?"
"What is this new prophecy, and what can it mean? Does the hangman really intend to bring about the future that Jonathan sees? And what are Jonathan's dark methods hinted at by Augustus? Could he truly be a butcher? Find out next time on The Gearheart."
This podcast is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license. For more information, visit creativecommons.org.
Today's podcast has been brought to you by Ratner's Rattaports, Tiny Trebuchets for the Stingy Siegeman. Looking to lay siege to the Lego Kingdom next door, but you're only armed with some Joint Strike Fighters and grenades? Try Rodney's Ratapults, miniaturized catapults, and put those fears of excessive property damage to rest. Choose from the Tiny Terror, the Mega Mouse, or the Undercompensator and do your worst. Rodney's Ratapults, miniaturized catapults. And by Whitcomb Brand Evil Cornstarch. Whipping up a batch of evil muffins or sinister pork chops? Savvy ladies use Whitcomb Brand Evil Cornstarch, made from only the finest evil corn, and they keep their house happy. Whitcomb Evil Corn is grown in 100% Cherokee burial ground, fertilized with chopped, not minced baby seals, and watered with orphan tears. Mmm, that's a sin you can savor. Whitcomb Brand Evil Cornstarch. Why go for original sin when you can choose Whitcomb?